Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michael Grubb, who is Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the Institute for Sustainable Resources at the Bartlett Faculty at the University College London, and Malcolm Key, who is Senior Research Fellow at the OIES. Now, we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from Michael's article, Disentangling the Debate on Electricity Redesign and Split Markets, that was published in the Institute's May 2023 Oxford Energy Forum publication titled Electricity Market Design During the Energy Transition and Energy Crisis. Now, during this podcast, we'll also discuss the two markets approach that Malcolm Key and David Robinson discussed in their June 2017 paper, The Decarbonized Electricity System of the Future, the Two Market Approach. This podcast is going to be part of two on this subject. The podcast today will examine the proposals and also the objections to the electricity redesign and split markets, when another podcast, which we'll release next week, we'll discuss the split market approach and potential adoption by Europe. Michael and Malcolm, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invite.
And thank you from me too. And hello, everyone.
Well, Michael, why did I start with you? You know, most of the responses to the UK government's consultation on electricity market design agreed that changes were needed to facilitate decarbonisation. But there was disagreement over whether the incremental change would be sufficient or whether there will be need for more fundamental restructuring. Now, your split market proposals seem really quite fundamental. So why do you think such big changes were necessary?
Well, I think ultimately big changes will be necessary for actually two quite distinct reasons. One is we have a way of running the electricity market which was really designed for a fossil fuel dominated system, whereas we have a system now which is at least half non-fossil, with ambition to get that half, you know, rapidly increasing towards a net zero electricity system in which fossil generators would be very minor. The reason that implies big changes in the structure is that, I'll call it a renewables or non-fossil dominated system, has fundamentally different characteristics in quite a few different ways. It's very much dominated by assets, capital investment that costs very little to run, but very substantially. Many other things as well. Location matters. The flows over networks can go two ways, etc. Totally unlike the fossil fuel system on which we built the current regulations, which, you know, large, centralized, dispatchable, reflecting the cost of running fossil fuels, which by and large set the price. So the second reason is what's been revealed by the energy price shocks, which is the energy crisis has driven up a huge increase in bills because the electricity price reflects predominantly the cost of the most expensive thing you need to generate to meet demand, and that's been gas. And as gas prices have shot through the roof, electricity prices have gone up enormously. And yet half of the system has nothing to do with fossil fuel costs. Its costs haven't changed, but consumers are still paying those costs. In economic terms, it's now become a huge wedge between the marginal cost of operating the system and the average cost of running it. And consumers have been footing that bill. So that's driven major problems and political ructions as well. So essentially the argument is because these are fundamentally different ways of generating electricity and fundamentally different systems, we actually need to disentangle those into two distinct markets.
That's an interesting argument, Michael. Malcolm, you know, have you got any kind of initial comments you'd like to make?
Well, I think essentially Michael and I share the same analysis of what the problem is. I'd just add that he's expressed it in terms of two different sorts of generating technologies. I'd also add that in a sense, you've got two different products. You've got always available on demand electricity and electricity that's only available when the generators are in use. So having two different sets of generators plus two different products seems to me a strong argument for having two different markets.
So, Michael, why don't I come back to you? You know, what would you say is the essence of your proposal, and what differences are there with other split market designs?
Well, first of all, there are several different ideas and variants on the same theme. So what we've actually looked most closely at is what we call a dual markets proposal, because it would involve, it's a separate, for simplicity terms, a green power pool, a pool of the renewable energy generators that would have an operator for that pool of energy, and it would have its electricity funneled through to consumers in ways that reflect the generation cost of those renewables rather than primarily the cost of the fossil fuels. But obviously, those consumers want firm power. So under that design, the pool would have responsibility when there wasn't enough renewable energy to buy from the wholesale market. But it would only pass those costs through on that additional electricity required. So it's a way of disentangling things on the generation side. There are then quite a few options as to how might that electricity be passed on to consumers. We can come back to the different ways of doing that.
And Malcolm, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, the I think the essential difference in the proposal that David Robinson and I have come forward with is this emphasis on consumers being faced directly with the nature of their consumption. As I said before, there are in essence two different products, and we think consumers should know at any particular time which product they're consuming. That is, with renewables, they should be faced not only with the cost of generation from renewables, but with the intermittency of those renewable sources, so that they know what they're getting, pay for what they're getting, and respond appropriately to that situation.
Now, Michael, your proposal seems to involve a lot of direct intervention from government. Now, for instance, in deciding how to allocate supplies from the proposed green pool and involving, you know, some element of price regulation. Now, do you think that this is an inevitable consequence of decarbonisation, or can you see it as an exit strategy which would enable the market to operate freely?
Well, I think actually there's evolutionary approaches here which don't involve major changes all in one go. Let me give you a clear example. To really illustrate this point, and when faced with this argument of, oh, we can't afford radical change or deter investors, etc., we already have, in effect, a pool of renewable generation supported through government contracts of what's called the Contracts for Differences. And there is already an institution which is the counterparty for those contracts, called the Low Carbon Contracts Company. So we already have the institution that is dealing with the economics of renewable generation. You don't actually need to change anything in terms of the generation side of the process. The most simple version of the green power pool is simply, rather than end up with, you know, those generators actually technically sell into the wholesale market, they may make a deficit or a surplus, they then have to reconcile that with the low carbon contracts company that then decides if there's recycled payments that go somewhere. It's actually quite a complicated system. Instead, you simply simplify it and say that volume of electricity at that price, reflecting the cost of those contracts for difference, should be made available to consumers. Where I think, ironically, there are more difficult decisions to be made is not interfering at all with the way the market, the generation market works. It would be saying, okay, so if there is a pool of renewables, which at least at present are substantially cheaper than the fossil fuel costs, how does that get fed through to consumers? That's a consumer side, and that's where I think there's some of the differences with the Oxford proposal. I think both are very interesting. And we know the government is looking at some of the options for effectively trying to put through the cost of renewables at the cost of renewables plus a margin to consumers, rather than people paying broadly the wholesale fossil fuel driven price. So, I actually think that if you think about it in that way, this isn't a radical disruptive change at all. It is simply taking the next step in saying, wait a minute, we're trying to build a system based on non-fossil sources. why on earth would we still have the electricity price almost entirely determined by the tail of the fossil fuel costs?
Malcolm, your proposal now looks particularly novel and complex. You know, is there not a risk that the uncertainty this creates would slow down the process of decarbonisation and inhibit investment?
Yes, I can see that risk. But first I'd say what Michael said, that it's actually less novel than it looks, because we've already got two markets, a separate market for renewables and for other plant. Secondly, there is a risk, but I think it's a manageable risk, and certainly there would need to be transitional elements to move from the present market to the new market. You'd need to keep most of the existing contracts in place, for instance, and maybe some of the existing approach, for instance, contracts for difference, would need to go on for a while to maintain the momentum of investment. But although there is a risk of uncertainty slowing things down, I also see a very large risk that unless you get the consumer voice being fed back into the system, you're going to end up with the government making every single decision on the new decarbonized system. And frankly, it's doing so not on a system-wide basis, but just on a step-by-step basis. It's effectively having, you know, one round after another of renewable support and getting a whole volume of renewables. There's nothing really to say it's the right sort of renewables in the right place and so on. It's just going for the cheapest outcome from each round. So I think you need, as soon as possible, given the huge amount of investment that's taking place, to enable consumers to get involved, to express their preferences, say what element, what level of reliability they really want, whether they want it provided by one sort of generation or by demand response or by in-house storage or by aggregation or whatever. And unless you can get that, we risk a huge misallocation of resources.
Michael, can I come back to you? Because one issue addressed in the consultation is the prospect that there would be an excess of potential generation, really for most of the time, from the mid-2030s. Now, under your proposals, how would this problem be addressed, and how would decisions be made about which generators would be dispatched at those times?
Well, I think those are really good questions, but what I find interesting in this whole area of electricity market reform is people tend to bundle all sorts of issues as if together and imply somehow can the green power pool solve that problem. That actual issue you've raised is what kind of contracts should be given to renewable energy generators? What kind of contracts should they be bidding for? What should those be the terms? Should they get fixed price contracts because they have that brings low capital costs, low risks, but then they're not exposed to this risk of what you call price cannibalization, or should they be exposed as market players? Now, just to give you a flavour, and if I can step back a little bit to the underlying economics of these dual market proposals, 2 points. First, let me just illustrate this with respect to the recent energy crisis. I mentioned the contracts for differences, but actually almost a quarter of the UK's generation now is from renewables that are on the system of renewable obligation certificates. They're selling into the wholesale market. They get a different top up. They're faced to the risks that you've just alluded to, that if the price crashes, they won't get much in the wholesale market. During the energy crisis last year, our estimate is those renewables increased revenues by £7.5 billion. Yeah, £7,500 million increased revenues when their own costs hadn't changed at all. That does not seem to be a sensible way of organising a system which has ever more renewables. Now, to some extent, that's solved by the contracts for difference for newer renewables, so some of that money gets recycled, though, as I say, in a slightly complex way. But the underlying question is what an economist would call the distinction between the marginal operating cost and the average cost of the system. With a lot of renewables, what we're really concerned is the average cost of the system, or one could say the long-run marginal cost of investing in renewables. Instead of which, under the kind of structures that we have at the moment, what you'll have is an operating price which is either way above the long-run marginal cost of renewables for brief periods when lots of not much wind, fossil fuel is costly, or the price will crash to zero and they can't recover the costs. And you're simply going to get a more and more volatile wholesale price. And you're expecting to have efficient investment in a clean renewable energy system based on a wholesale price which is oscillating like a yo-yo, unless, as Malcolm said, you pile everything into government-backed CFDs and then effectively the government is underwriting the entire electricity system. Though neither of those sound like sensible ways to build a renewables-dominated system for the future.
Malcolm, coming to you, your proposal seems to rely a lot on active demand response, but what is the evidence that consumers want to play an active role? If it turns out that they don't, is there any point in making such a fundamental change in the first place?
I think there's indeed a question mark about how active a role consumers want to play. But I think there is evidence that if they're presented with a simple, predictable choice, they are prepared to do so. The classic example are the off-peak tariffs that have existed in the United Kingdom, like Economy 7, where people do change their habits. But that's because it's been made very easy for them. The tariffs, when they were first offered, were sort of bundled in with appropriate heating and so on. If you could do something similar with the two market systems, so you could have a predictable price in the as available market, as we've called it, you could bundle in with products like, say, batteries or responsive equipment, which would enable you to take advantage of it. If you make the whole process very simple for consumers, they will respond. And it doesn't actually require them to do so necessarily themselves all the time. As long as there's an incentive on suppliers, which is would exist in the system we've evolved, they could arrange all this. They could arrange the equipment. They could arrange the sort of security of supply and how it's supplied. So you wouldn't necessarily need consumers all to be very geeky, electrically oriented people who want to do something all the time. But you could produce, as with Economy 7, a significant consumer response by setting up circumstances in which that was simply the consequence of the, the tariff situation and the equipment situation they found themselves in. So I don't think that's, that just judging demand response on the basis of some rather marginal experiments taking place today is the way to think about it.
I'd like to follow up on Malcolm's comment, actually, because I think there's a lot of simplification about how flexible have individual households proven to be in a limited number of experiments. That's not the issue. Let me give another example with respect to completely different sets of consumers. If we look at industry, some industrials have limited capacity to flex, some have a lot. And by and large, industries are also very concerned with the predictability of electricity prices. Now, we're in a context where we're trying to decarbonize industry and electricity. In the UK, the government has offered more than £500 million for steel plants to convert to electricity. Those steel plants would have to invest a couple of billion. Two things about this. One, in the current system, they are facing an incredibly uncertain and volatile fuel price. Whereas if one had a model along of either variance on a split or dual markets approach, they could basically buy into contracts based on the very well-known cost of renewable energy. But the other thing is that something like an electric arc can offer a huge degree of flexibility. You can turn electric arcs on or off, large volume of flexible response, provided the consumers have an effective way of contracting with the renewables and are then faced with, if you're not going to, for example, scale back demand when the wind is low, you're going to be facing the higher cost of buying fossil fuels. That's the essence, and that you can get through either of these channels. For large steel plants, you'd be doing it directly. For other consumers, as Malcolm says, you'd be going through suppliers. But suppliers, when faced with that combination, would have an incentive to then work out which of their customers or how to help their customers also be more flexible. So, it's the essence is you have to get, in effect, these two very different streams of electricity with these very different price and output characteristics. You have to feed those signals down through the rest of the system. That's the essence of what both Malcolm and I are saying.
Okay, Michael, now your proposals involve balancing purchases to ensure reliable supplies. So, you know, would a capacity market also be needed in this part of the market? Or, you know, would marginal price signals be enough? And also, you know, who would decide on the required level of reliability?
So again, that's a great question. My personal view is that security is so fundamental, and the economics of private actors providing security are so risky, that there is a role for government. Now, what one could argue is that if you had the kind of dual markets proposal that we're talking about, the actual market maker, particularly once renewables got to a large volume, a large fraction of the system, that they would have the best oversight of the dynamics of the variability of the renewables, and ultimately they should be contributing to funding capacity adequacy. But that would be informed also by their knowledge of how much flexibility were consumers bringing. That is really vital. The risk of a purely supply-side capacity mechanism, or one designed largely on the assumption that security comes from backup generators, misses the huge contribution of demand-side flexibility, small-scale storage, etc. So, yes, I think there's a continued role for government, exactly whether that's exercised through the current capacity market or maybe just a strategic reserve with much more emphasis upon market-based security to complement that, is not fundamentally a decision around split markets. That's just a judgment call that the government has to take.
So, Malcolm, your proposals, you know, effectively involve the privatization of electricity security of supply. Now, surely, you know, politicians, you know, may not be prepared to take this risk. What do you think?
Well, I can see that there is a problem of perceptions here. Although you say it involves a privatization of electricity security of supply, I don't think it need affect the level of security of supply. What it affects is how you pay for it and what decisions consumers make about it. I think there is a difficulty in moving downstream to the level of consumers. Basically, electricity decarbonisation so far has nearly all been done upstream by introducing renewables. Consumers haven't been affected except through the price. Governments, unfortunately or fortunately, are going to have to bite this bullet when it comes to the next stage of decarbonisation, with, say, home heating or with electric vehicles. Consumers are going to be affected. They're going to have to change their behavior in many ways. They're going to have different equipment. And politicians simply can't go on saying we can do decarbonization in a way that doesn't affect consumers. So that's the first point. The second is, I speak both from personal experience. I've once lived in a country where electricity supply was very irregular, and from looking at the sort of data for the value of lost load and so on for consumers. There is a huge variation for consumers in how important security of supply is from any one moment to the next. It depends what they're doing, you know, and what the circumstances are. Often their need is simply to have, say, electricity to power a computer or some lights or something. So we're not necessarily talking about an absolute use or non-use of electricity. We're talking about responding, changing your electricity consumption in response to price signals rather than on or off. And that is actually relatively easy, I would say, both from personal experience and from the survey data. People are prepared to do that once they start being exposed to that sort of a situation. And it doesn't take long to adapt to it. So I'm fairly confident that this is possible. Obviously, it's difficult to be absolutely certain until we try it out. So I think some degree of experimentation is involved. But as Michael has said, that there are lots and lots of reasons to believe that some flexibility in consumer response is there and is much greater than most people think.
Michael and Malcolm, thank you very much for your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from the article Disentangling the Debate on Energy Redesign and Split Markets that was published in the Institute's May 2023 Oxford Energy Forum, a publication titled Electricity Market Design During the Energy Transition and Energy Crisis. Now, in this podcast, as I said earlier, we also discussed elements of the June 2017 paper, the Decarbonized Electricity System for the Future, the Two Markets Approach. This is the first of two podcasts on the subject of electricity redesign and split markets. The second, which will address specifically the split market approach and possible adoption by Europe, will be released by the Institute next week. Look out for it. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.